From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Stephen King has just received a medal for distinguished contribution to American letters at this year's National Book Awards ceremony. He's one of our most prolific writers and a great interview as well. On today's Fresh Air, we'll listen back to two interviews with Stephen King. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg talks about the differences between American and British English in light of President George Bush's trip to England. And film critic David Edelstein reviews The Cat in the Hat, starring Mike Myers and Alec Baldwin. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. A massive energy bill has come to a screeching halt in the Senate. Supporters were two votes short of the 60 they needed to end debate on the matter, despite swift passage in the Republican-led House earlier this week. The bill has been a top priority for President Bush, who this past hour urged GOP Senate leaders to keep it alive.
This nation needs an energy bill. It needs an energy plan. Minority of senators are holding it up. For the sake of our national security and economic security, the Senate's got to pass this bill.
There were about half a dozen Senate Republicans who joined Democrats today to block the energy bill. But NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol that GOP leaders have vowed the battle is far from over.
New Mexico Republican Pete Domenici says he'll keep pushing colleagues to agree to an up or down vote on the energy bill.
I don't want to think that all those senators that voted against this bill today want to stay on that side of this issue. I think they'd like to be on the other side.
The Senate's GOP leaders need to pick up two more votes to break the filibuster. But Senate Democratic leader Tom Daschle says it's the bill that must change.
The comprehensive energy bill, the Senate's failure this morning to break this filibuster was as unnecessary as it is unfortunate. It is a classic example of insisting on provisions that were simply too much for the traffic to bear.
Daschle says removing a provision shielding the makers of the fuel additive MTBE from lawsuits would ensure the bill's passage. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
The former Soviet Republic of Georgia is bracing for a weekend of mass protests that organizers hope will force the resignation of veteran President Edward Shevardnadze. Opposition forces accused Shevardnadze's government of massive corruption, rigging a parliamentary election. NPR's Lawrence Sheets has more from Tbilisi.
Thousands of protesters in buses and cars have begun to arrive in the capital. Opposition forces vowed to block Saturday's gathering of the new parliament, which they claim was fraudulently elected. President Shevardnadze's party came in first in the election held on November 2nd. But international observers and the U.S. State Department criticized widespread falsification during the vote. Shevardnadze is remembered in the West for helping to end the Cold War when he was Soviet foreign minister during the 1980s. But he's increasingly unpopular at home. Poverty, corruption, and unresolved separatist conflicts have marked his rule. Shevardnadze's top security advisor warned that Georgia was edging dangerously toward violent unrest. Lawrence Sheets, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials Average closed up 9 points to settle at 9,628. The Nasdaq was up 12 points at 1,893. This is NPR. Authorities in western India have imposed a curfew to try and prevent violence following a bomb attack at a mosque today that injured at least 26 people. Veer Singh has more from New Delhi.
The attack has sparked tensions, with groups of youths throwing stones and setting shops on fire, according to local news reports. Government officials in India's western state of Maharashtra, where the attack took place, have ordered tight security in an attempt to prevent clashes between the minority Muslim community and Hindus. The state's deputy chief minister says the situation is tense but under control. He says the government has no idea who is responsible for the mosque bombing, which occurred as worshippers were leaving for their homes after Friday prayers. The Indian state has suffered a series of explosions during the last year, most of them in the capital, Bombay. For NPR News, I'm Veer Singh in New Delhi.
The Bush administration warns there could be more attacks on American interests overseas. Law enforcement and government officials received a classified security bulletin this week in the wake of stepped-up attacks in Iraq and Turkey. Today, the U.S. specifically warned of heightened security threats in Nigeria. Americans there are being warned to stay alert. The President and First Lady are back home at the White House after wrapping up a state visit in Britain. President Bush reaffirmed his commitment to fighting terrorism. British Prime Minister Tony Blair echoed that call. The message to fight terror came in the wake of attacks on British interests in Turkey and several anti-war protests in London. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Warner Home Video and JFK, two-disc special edition, a film by Oliver Stone, including Beyond JFK, The Question of Conspiracy, now available.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. This week, Stephen King won an honorary National Book Award for Lifetime Achievement. The author of such bestsellers as Carrie and The Shining, King was a controversial choice for this National Literary Prize. Some writers and critics consider him too commercially successful to be considered in the same class with the likes of former honorees Philip Roth and Arthur Miller. But King's many supporters argue that his work transcends its popular horror genre. Today we feature two interviews Terry recorded with Stephen King. The first took place in 1992, after the publication of his novel, Gerald's Game.
As the book opens, a married couple is in their forest cabin. They're ready to play their S&M sex game. She's on the bed, her wrists are cuffed to the bedpost. He's undressing. She realizes she's tired of this game. It seems stupid, ridiculous, and corny. But she can't get her husband to stop, and that makes her furious. As he forces himself on her, she kicks him where it hurts most. He collapses, suffers a heart attack, and dies. And she's alone, cuffed to the bed, in the middle of the woods. Now the horror really begins. I ask King what made him think about how corny sex games can be.
Actually, Gerald's Game started with the concept of the woman being chained to the bed. I'd written a book before where a woman and a small child were stuck in a car that was sort of surrounded, if you will, by a rabid St. Bernard. That book was called Cujo. And essentially what a lot of that book was two people in a very small room, although it did have a shifting perspective so that it went to other characters. And I thought originally this was the takeoff point for the book. Wouldn't it be interesting to see what would happen if you had one character in a room? The question then became, what caused this woman to be in this room by herself? And the answer that I came up with was bondage. She's handcuffed to a bed. And that forced me to sort of consider what causes people to do this sort of thing. And so once I'd set up the situation, I knew what it was going to be. I went in and read a little bit about it and thought a little bit about it. And the whole thing struck me as a little bit Victorian. There was something very snidely whiplash about the whole thing, and I tried to get that into the book.
Let's get Stephen King to the kind of gore and terror and suspense that you create. There's a scene in Gerald's Game, your new novel, that I'd like you to read from. And this is a scene in which the wife is still handcuffed to the bedpost. Her husband is laying dead on the floor, and a stray vicious dog from the area has walked in to the house and has started dining on the woman's dead husband. Would you read it for us?
I sure will. Gerald's widow's peak was in disarray, probably as a result of the dog's licking the blood out of it. But his glasses were still firmly in place. She could see his eyes, half open and glazed, glaring up from their puffy sockets at the fading sun ripples on the ceiling. His face was still a mask of ugly red and purple blotches, as if even death had not been able to assuage his anger at her sudden capricious. Had he seen it as capricious? Of course he had. Change of mind. Let go of him, she told the dog, but her voice was now meek and sad and strengthless. The dog barely twitched its ears at the sound of it and didn't pause at all. It merely went on pulling the thing with the disarrayed widow's peak and the blotchy complexion. This thing no longer looked like Disco Gerald, not a bit. Now it was only dead Gerald, sliding across the bedroom floor with a dog's teeth buried in its flabby biceps. A frayed flap of skin hung over the dog's snout. Jessie tried to tell herself it looked like wallpaper, but wallpaper did not, at least as far as she knew, come with moles and a vaccination scar. Now she could see Gerald's pink, fleshy belly, marked only by the small caliber bullet hole that was his navel. His penis flopped and dangled in its nest of black pubic hair. His buttocks whispered along the hardwood boards with ghastly, frictionless ease. Abruptly, the suffocating atmosphere of her terror was pierced by a shaft of anger so bright it was like a stroke of heat lightning inside her head. She did more than accept this new emotion. She welcomed it. Rage might not help her get out of this nightmarish situation, but she sensed it would serve as an antidote to her growing sense of shocked unreality. "You bastard," she said in a low, trembling voice. "You cowardly, slinking bastard."
That's Stephen King reading from his novel, Gerald's Game. Do you think of yourself as having taken the horror novel to a kind of more physically explicit place than it had ever been before?
Yeah, I think that to some degree I did do that. I think probably I've been surpassed in that area by some of the people who've come after me. I'm thinking mostly of Clive Barker.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you realize that when I started reading and experiencing horror, some of it that I was reading and experiencing came from a very graphic wellspring. And I'm thinking about the horror comics of the 1950s, things like Tales from the Crypt and the mm-hmm. Vault of Horror that can now be seen on home box office. And at the same time, I was discovering horror movies. I usually went by myself in the afternoon to the Highway Theater in Stratford, Connecticut, which is still there, incidentally, and saw things like I Was a Teenage Werewolf with Michael Landon, or I Was a Teenage Frankenstein, or whatever it happened to be. And it was there that I started to see that it might be possible to combine some of the classic elements with some of the things that I was seeing in the schlock press and the schlock movies.
When you would see movies like this, did they scare you or just amuse you?
No, they scared me. You have to remember that we're talking 10 or 11 years old, and even with a picture like Teenage Monster, where the flying saucer appeared to be a cool cigarette filter tip with a sparkler stuck in it, that it looked real to me because I was at a young and very credulous age. And one of the other things that I sensed as time went past and I got a little more discriminating in my ability to detect special effects, if not necessarily my sense of taste, was that when I wrote it, you never saw the zipper going up the monster's back, that when the imagination was in charge of special effects, they were always perfect as the book was, anyway.
Mm-hmm. What did you like about being scared when you were young?
I liked the total surrender of emotional control. It was very important to me, and I would almost be willing to say sort of a lifesaver. I'd been raised in a family where emotional control was a really important thing. You weren't supposed to show you were afraid. You weren't supposed to show that you were in pain or frightened or sad. Happiness was permissible as long as it didn't go too far, because then one might be considered to be almost insane if one got too happy. So that emotional control was, you know, sort of a requirement. And for me, the terror was what really appealed to something that I think is probably just inside people, that there isn't any logical way to explain it. But I loved it, and I loved giving up that control.
To write the kind of fiction that you do, you really have to think about how people respond when they're terrified and how they deal with pain, how they deal with pain and with fear and terror. Do you handle pain well, and has that ability ever really been tested?
You know, I don't think anybody knows how they deal with pain. Everybody's pain is so individual, and so we have no basis for comparison. I think that pain is really the ocean that's between us. You know, I think it was John Donne said, "No man is an island." But in fact, I'm sorry, John, but we are. And when you're dying of cancer, you do it alone. And when you have migraine headaches, which is something that I'm prone to, you do that alone. But if I have a really terrible headache, what I call one of my headbusters, I wonder how that would stack up against someone else's pain. But I don't know, because there's no way to tell. There's no valid basis for comparison because we don't feel each other's pain. The interesting thing to me, more interesting than pain in my life or the comparative levels of that sort of thing, is that experiences about pain and experiences of extreme terror, I think, make it possible to see the world that we live in, the mundane, everyday world, in much greater detail. Small things, unimportant things, stand forth in a way that they don't. My experience of being under tremendous stress, physical stress or emotional or mental stress, is that things that otherwise just sort of fall outside what we think of as the tunnel of perception, our tunnel vision, kind of spring forward again, and I see them all over again. For me and Gerald's game, some of the most interesting passages, there's one section where this woman has to get a glass of water off a shelf, and in another one, she realizes that because she is handcuffed to the bed, she can't quite get the glass to her lips. And what she does then is, for me, was one of the most interesting and challenging parts of writing the book, not because it's an adventure, but because it uses very prosaic, everyday things to make suspense. And so it makes us look at him again and say, oh, what is that? And that's the experience, it seems to me, of brand new perception, of childhood, that sort of reaction of, oh, look at that. And maybe the adult doesn't see that thing at all.
When you started publishing your novels and people started reading them and people who you knew understood more what went through your mind, the kind of thoughts that you had, did people start to see you differently?
I think so. There was a sort of, I won't say pulling away exactly, but a kind of, you'd see a kind of question in their eyes, sort of like, where are all the bodies buried, Steve? or there would be this sort of casual, by the way, Steve, what was your childhood like? Were you ever beaten? Did they burn you with cigarettes, or what was it? And I would say, really, I'm just like you are. And then they would step away.
That would be the worst news.
Yeah. Basically, all I'm doing is saying things that other people are afraid to say. The job's not much different than being a comedy writer. Basically, you say, what is the one thing that nobody wants to talk about that everybody will sort of raise their hands in horror? Well, not everybody, because you never get everybody, but what can I say that will be the literary equivalent of taking a fork and scraping it across a blackboard, you know, or making somebody bite in on a lemon? And when I find those things, generally the reaction from the readers or the people even who see the films is one of, thank you for saying that. Thank you for articulating that thought.
Your story, Misery, was about a psychotic fan who tortures her favorite writer because he's let her down with the plot of the new novel.
Mm-hmm.
and you, in a way, have become a kind of magnet for a few kind of crazy fans. Was the story of Misery based on one particular fear or one particular incident?
I don't think so. There are a number of things. Yes, I've been a lightning rod for a certain number of crazy people. We keep files on them. They are constant correspondents, and they want to be infinitely, intimately involved with my life or the lives of my family or whatever. Or they believe that they actually wrote the stories or that you're picking their brains telepathically or whatever it is. And you begin to realize the power of fans. And, of course, it's just interacting with them, there is a kind of fan psychology that, for the object of that fan adulation, gets to be really, really uncomfortable sometimes. They want your autograph. They want to tell you how much they enjoy their stuff. And if you say, look, I'd love to sign your books, but I can't right now. I'm taking my family out to dinner, or I really have to be over here. Their reaction is, go to hell, you son of a bitch. You know, just like that, it changes.
Yeah, that's pretty frightening.
So you sense in the people who are the most devoted fans this really sort of churning need to identify emotionally or psychologically with the object of the, you know, the fan worship. And sometimes this actual resentment, this feeling of, you have what was really meant for me. In the best of all possible worlds, I would be you. And you see this quite often in the male. So there's a lot of times this adulation and there's this really uncomfortable undercurrent of resentment at the same time.
Stephen King, speaking with Terry Gross in 1992. King is this year's recipient of an honorary National Book Award for Lifetime Achievement. After the break, we'll feature another interview Terry recorded with him in 2000. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're featuring interviews with writer Stephen King, who received an honorary National Book Award this week. Terry Gross spoke with him in 2000, not long after the accident which nearly took his life. In June of 1999, King was walking along the gravel shoulder of Route 5, a two-lane highway near his home in Maine, when he was struck by a van. His hip was dislocated, several ribs were broken, and his right leg, knee, and hip were shattered. At the time of this interview, King was still recovering from his injuries, but he had already returned to work and had published a memoir called On Writing. Terry asked King to begin with a reading from the last chapter of this book about his accident.
Most of the sight lines along the mile of Route 5 which I walk are good, but there is one stretch, a short, steep hill, where a pedestrian walking north can see very little of what might be coming his way. I was three-quarters of the way up this hill when Brian Smith, the owner and operator of the Dodge van, came over the crest. He wasn't on the road. He was on the shoulder. My shoulder. I had perhaps three-quarters of a second to register this. It was just time enough to think, my God, I'm going to be hit by a school bus. I started to turn to my left. There is a break in my memory here. On the other side of it, I'm on the ground, looking at the back of the van, which is now pulled off the road and tilted to one side. This recollection is very clear and very sharp, more like a snapshot than a memory. There is dust around the van's taillights. The license plate and the back windows are dirty. I register these things with no thought that I have been in an accident or of anything else. It's a snapshot, that's all. I'm not thinking. My head has been swapped clean. There's another little break in my memory here, and then I am very carefully wiping palmfuls of blood out of my eyes with my left hand. When my eyes are reasonably clear, I look around and see a man sitting on a nearby rock. He has a cane drawn across his lap. This is Brian Smith, 42 years of age, the man who hit me with his van. Smith has got quite the driving record. He has racked up nearly a dozen vehicle-related offenses. Smith wasn't looking at the road on the afternoon our lives came together because his Rottweiler had jumped from the very rear of his van into the back seat area where there was an Igloo cooler with some meat stored inside. The Rottweiler's name is Bullet. Smith has another Rottweiler at home. That one is named Pistol. Bullet started to nose at the lid of the cooler. Smith turned around and tried to push Bullet away. He was still looking at Bullet and pushing his head away from the cooler when he came over the top of the knoll, still looking and pushing when he struck me. Smith told friends later that he thought he'd hit a small deer until he noticed my bloody spectacles lying on the front seat of his van. They were knocked from my face when I tried to get out of Smith's way. The frames were bent and twisted, but the lenses were unbroken. They are the lenses I'm wearing now as I write this. Smith sees I'm awake and tells me help is on the way. He speaks calmly, even cheerily. His look, as he sits on his rock with his cane drawn across his lap, is one of pleasant commiseration. Ain't the two of us just had the shittiest luck, it says. He and Bullitt left the campground where they were staying, he later tells an investigator, because he wanted some of those Maz's bars they have up to the store. When I hear this little detail some weeks later, it occurs to me that I have nearly been killed by a character out of one of my own novels. It's almost funny.
That's Stephen King reading from his new memoir on writing. Did Smith say anything to you, anything else to you, as you were laying there drifting in and out of consciousness after he hit you?
He said, "I've never had so much as a parking ticket in my life, and here it is my bad luck to hit the best-selling writer in the world." And I think he said, "I loved all your movies."
Did he really say that?
Yeah.
So he's lying to you as you're lying there, nearly dying?
Well, he said he had never had so much as a parking ticket, and God knows he had a lot of traffic offenses. We don't want to speak ill of the dead if we can help it, because he did die last month, and on my birthday, as a matter of fact, which
no.
is a little bit eerie.
Yeah.
He and I share the same middle name as well. We're both Edwins. We were. Now I'm, well, never mind.
You know, in that reading, you say that it made you think that he was like a character in your fiction. Were there other things that made you think of him that way?
Well, God knows that I've lived in rural Maine for a lot of years. It's where I grew up, and it's where my wife and I live now, in a town of about 900 people. And we don't want to say that Brian Smith is or was a type, because I don't necessarily believe that there are types, but he had a certain backcountry quality with the Rottweiler dogs and the old van, and it's really tough, Terry, to talk about Brian Smith without making him sound like a sort of Faulknerian stereotype, and so I'd just as soon steer clear of the whole issue. He was like a character in a Stephen King book, but only because he seemed like a real Maine type to me.
Stephen King speaking with Terry Gross in 2000. We'll hear more of their conversation in the second half of the show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of The Art of the Bookplate, an illustrated history and celebration with a foreword by George Plimpton, available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com, and from Warner Home Video and JFK, two-disc special edition, a film by Oliver Stone, including Beyond JFK, The Question of Conspiracy, now available. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, horror novelist Stephen King tells us what scared him when he was little. Also, Jeff Nunberg considers the differences between British and American English, and David Edelstein reviews The Cat in the Hat.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's interview with horror novelist Stephen King, recorded in 2000, shortly after the accident that nearly took his life, and also the publication of his memoir, On Writing. King received an honorary National Book Award this week for lifetime achievement. His novels include Carrie, The Shining, Cujo, Misery, The Dead Zone, Salem's Lot, and his latest, The Dark Tower 5.
In an interview in Salon magazine before the accident, you said, "As a kid, my mother used to say when we were scared, whatever you're afraid of, say it three times fast and it will never happen." And that's what I've done in my fiction. Basically, I've said out loud the things that really terrify me, and I've turned them into fictions, and they've made a very nice living for me, and it seems to have worked. Did you ever feel that this time the horror stories jinxed you, that something that you feared and had written about was coming true?
No, it never even crossed my mind. It's strange because off and on in my career as a writer, I have certainly written about car crashes and about characters who've been hurt or injured in car crashes. There's a little boy who's killed by a truck in Pet Sematary. And in a book that's done in manuscript but hasn't been polished yet and readied for publication called From a Buick 8, one of the main characters' father is killed in an accident very similar to the one that almost killed me. But I only use those things in my stories because cars and traffic accidents are a part of our lives. They're something that, unfortunately, most of us relate to, probably at a rate of three or four times as much. That is to say, three or four times as many people either have been in a car accident themselves or know somebody who has, as have been injured with gunshots. So it's a part of the American experience, and as such, of course, I've written about it, but I never felt that I jinxed myself, no.
When you were on Fresh Air a few years ago and we were talking about the things that scared you most as a kid, you mentioned something that you also describe in your new book On Writing. You talked about how when you were a kid you had strep throat and after that you had a terrible ear infection. And in treating it, the doctor had to, with a needle, puncture your eardrum on three separate occasions to let the infection drain. And it was the worst agony you'd ever experienced. And of course, the doctor, before doing the procedure, kept saying that it wasn't going to hurt. You've had to go through excruciating pain as an adult now as a result of the accident and the procedures and therapies that you've had to do as well. How is dealing with the pain of the accident, the surgeries, the procedures, dealing with that pain as an adult compared to dealing with it as a child?
Well, as an adult, I always felt a lot more as though I were a participant in what was happening to me. For instance, the therapy, and anybody who's been in a bone-crunching accident knows that it's a very, very difficult procedure to go through. When I woke up, I was in something that's called an external fixator, which is a halo that goes over the leg, and it mobilizes the bone. It also immobilizes the joints so that from June 19th, I think, until probably, toward the end of July, I never bent my knee. And in the old days, the 20s and 30s, when people recovered from this sort of accident, their leg was more or less frozen in place, so it became an organic crutch. And nowadays, at least we have therapeutic techniques to restore mobility to the leg, but it's very, very painful. And I can remember, in the On Writing book, I talk about the having my ears lanced to let out, to drain moisture and pus that was behind the eardrum. But as a child, when you're faced with a procedure like that, you're in a uniquely powerless situation because you don't understand what's going on. And you're powerless to stop it in any case. You were mentioning I had to go back three times. And the first time when I was told, "Don't worry, this won't hurt," I believed it. The second time, I almost believed it. And the third time, I knew that it wasn't true, but I was still powerless to stop it. And to me, that's the ingredient of a nightmare, even down to the fact that the doctor never called me Stephen. He called me Robert. He would say, "Now, Robert, lie down. This won't hurt." And In my panicky child's way, I'm thinking, of course it will hurt. Of course it will hurt. You're even lying about what my name is. But when you get to be an adult, although it still hurts, the pain is still there. I felt as though I were something of a participant in my own therapy, so that the first step was to get the knee to flex enough so that the leg would come down and the heel would touch the floor. And the pain of just that was excruciating, and I just filled the house with my howls. I can't imagine how my poor wife ever stood it, but the physical therapist, Anne, just would laugh and say, you can do a little bit more, Stephen. And I'd think, no, I can't. I can't do any more, Anne. Stop it. Let me stop. And she wouldn't, and then come the weights on the leg and all the rest of it. But you, at least you know what's going on, and you know, understand what the stakes are. And when it came to having my ear lanced, children just don't understand.
You know, in Misery, the main character is a writer who's seriously injured, and the woman taking care of him, his number one fan, is really torturing him and not giving him therapy. Did the nurses and therapists who you worked with make zillions of Misery jokes?
You know, they'd all read Misery, but they worked for an outfit called the Bangor Area Visiting Nurses. These are nurses who go into the home and give home care. And I think one of them told me toward the end of the period where I needed full-time nursing that they had all read it and they had all been called into the office by their superior and told in no uncertain terms, don't make any Misery jokes.
And did they restrain themselves?
They did. They were great.
Yeah, as you point out in your new book on writing, one of the plots that has interested you in several of your books is, if there is a God, why do such terrible things happen? Mm-hmm. And that's one of the themes in The Stand, Desperation, The Green Mile. Is that the kind of thing you were wondering about yourself after the accident? And I'm wondering if you believe in God, if you did before the accident, if you did after the accident.
Oh, I've always believed in God. I also think that's the sort of thing that either comes as part of the equipment, the capacity to believe, or at some point in your life, when you're in a position where you actually need help from a power greater than yourself, you simply make an agreement. I will believe in God because it will make my life easier and richer to believe than not to believe. So I choose to believe. Then, of course, you're left with these questions. Why did this happen to me? You know, it's there's a story that I've told a couple of times about Job. You know, the sorrows of Job. Job loses his wife. He loses his children. He's covered with diseases. His land is taken away from him. All these sorrows. And finally, Job goes down to the coast of the ocean and faces the waves and says, God, all these terrible things have happened to me, all these things, and I still love you, but I want to know why. Why did these things have to happen to me? Why did they have to happen to Job, your good and faithful servant? And this cyclone comes down, and it comes across the waves, and it stops in front of him, and it says, Job, I guess you just piss me off. And that's one way of looking at how God treats us. I can also say, God, why did this have to happen to me, when if I get another step back, you know, the guy misses me entirely? Then God says to me, in the voice that I hear in my head, which probably comes from the boys in the basement as much as from God, the muses that I have, these guys say, on the other hand, Steve, if you'd taken another step forward, you would have been killed. You didn't have any permanent nerve damage. You've got a numb place on your leg, but your foot works and your leg works. So there are all these things. And then these voices can go on and say, Steve, why don't you get serious? 6 million Jews were killed in the 30s and 40s as a part of, Hitler's little ethnic cleansing program, and a million more Bosnian Serbs were killed in their program of ethnic cleansing in the mid-90s. So what are you complaining about? You got a little busted hip. Why don't you just, you know, pick yourself up and dust yourself off and get over it, and don't be worrying about things you can't understand. So again, I think that you make an agreement and you say to yourself, okay, there's a God. Why? Because I choose to believe there's a God. Believing makes my life better than not believing. Why did this happen to me? It happened to me for some good purpose. What is that good purpose? I don't know, but I choose to believe it's good, because to believe it's bad would bum out my whole day.
I had read that you were going to buy the van that struck you and smash it. Did that actually happen?
It never did happen. The van has been cubed. When I was in the hospital, mostly unconscious, my wife got a lawyer who's just a friend of the family. My son and his son went to school together, so we know him really well. And she got in touch with him and said, buy it so that somebody else doesn't buy it and decide to break it up and sell it on eBay, on the internet. And so he did, and for about 6 months, I did have these sort of fantasies of smashing the van up. But my wife, I don't always listen to her the first time, but sooner or later, she usually gets through, and what she says makes more sense than what I had planned. And her thought was that the best thing to do would be to very quietly remove it from this plane of existence, which is what we did.
Oh, and you can't say how?
Sure I can. It went through a car crusher. It's a little cube somewhere.
Oh, so rather than you attacking it yourself,
Yeah.
And did you keep the cube?
No, I didn't. I don't really know what happened to the cube. But my idea about the van had always been to sort of smash it up the way that in the carnies of my youth, sometimes somebody would put a car up on the back of a flatbed truck and charge a quarter for three smacks with a sledgehammer. And I thought we could do that for charity. And it still, at times, seems to me like a good idea. But I have sort of a carnival mind, and my wife is a little bit more sober.
Stephen King recorded in 2000. This week, he received a Lifetime Achievement Award from the National Book Foundation. Here's King singing Stand By Me, the song used in his film adaptation of the same name. Warren Zevon was at the piano.
This is where it all begins. When the night has come, the land is dark, and the moon is the only light we'll see. I won't cry, I won't cry, no, I won't shed a tear. Just as long as you stand by me. And darling, darling, stand by me.
Stand by me.
Just as long as you stand by me. Now listen. If the sky we look upon crumble and fall, and the mountains should tumble into the sea, I won't cry, I won't cry,
I won't cry.
No, I won't shed a tear.
No,
just as long as you stand by me. And darling, darling, stand.
The Lord has given you two good strong legs and two big strong feet. So what I want you to do, my sweet thing, is to get up off that sofa. I mean, get up off your ass. Get on your feet. Get up on them big strong legs next to your big strong legs.
Coming up, Jeff Nunberg on the English language and our complicated relations with Britain. This is Fresh Air. British defenders of Tony Blair's policies in Iraq have been stressing the special relationship between the U.S. and Britain based on common ties of language. But as our linguist Jeff Nunberg points out, those family ties, like all family ties, are complicated.
As British demonstrators were organizing for yesterday's anti-Bush protests, the right-wing Daily Mail warned that if they damaged the relationship with America, they would damage Britain as well. This is our closest and most reliable ally, the papers said, tied to us by a shared commitment to freedom, by a common language and a common history, not to mention immensely important trade links. The references to a common language are de rigueur whenever Britons are defending the special relationship, a phrase that they use a lot more than we do. But historically speaking, it was the special relationship that created the common language rather than the other way around. It wasn't inevitable that the two nations would think of themselves as speaking the same language. People often distinguish separate languages with varieties that are no more distinct than British and American are, like Dutch and Afrikaans or Norwegian and Danish. In fact, in the decades following the American Revolution, people like Adams and Jefferson argued that Americans should break off their linguistic ties with England, just as they'd thrown off its political yoke. Not that we were about to switch to speaking Greek or German, but over the course of time, American would become a language distinct from the rest of the world, as Noah Webster put it. And just to make the point symbolically, Webster went about changing American spelling so that Americans and Englishmen would wind up writing honor in different ways. It wasn't until 50 or 60 years later that the English and Americans grudgingly accepted that they would maintain their linguistic union, like a couple that goes through a trial separation and then decides to stick it out. That realization no doubt reflected the pull of a common literary and political heritage, but it also owed a lot to the neurotic dependencies that can bind families more closely than mere history does. If England and America didn't think of themselves as speaking the same language, after all, the English couldn't accuse us of mangling it. And we couldn't have the satisfaction of knowing how much our cheeky linguistic hijinks annoyed those stiff grown-ups back in the parlor. The British have always had a high time portraying Americans as backwoods buffoons who spout a mixture of slang, malaprops, and bloated pomposities. For them, America was the source of all linguistic corruption in something like the way we think of California today. In 1869, the English critic G.F. Graham accused Americans of taking reckless liberties with the language. Words like slick, spry, and boss are not English words, he said, and we may pretty confidently expect that they will never become English. True, the British have always overdrawn their depictions of American speech. Dickens parodied it so broadly in his American Notes that Emerson felt obliged to complain that no such conversations ever occur in this country in real life. But if no American actually talks like those caricatures, George Bush comes pretty close. British critics of Bush and his policies may make a point of saying that their beef is with the president and not the country. But it's certainly convenient that Bush fits the negative stereotype of Americans so neatly. For their purposes, he's a self-made straw man. The London Sunday Times, which has been supportive of Bush, recently asked 2,000 Britons which characteristics they most associate with the U.S. president. The largest proportion said he was a danger to world peace, but that response was closely followed by the adjective stupid and incoherent. And in the Times of London last week, the conservative columnist Matthew Paris observed, not entirely approvingly, that these days any English comic can get a laugh with a joke that depicts Bush as a loud, bumptious, ignorant, crass, narrow-minded, conspiring, lethal zealot. As Parrish notes, the trouble with Bush jokes is that they're really about Americans. Of course, a lot of people on this side of the pond think of Bush as a kind of America joke, too. That's the price we Americans pay for the special relationship. We all have a little introjected Englishman sitting on our shoulders, clucking his tongue at our ignorance and faulty grammar. and it can be embarrassing to see the flesh and blood embodiment of those deficiencies sharing a platform with Tony Blair. But nowadays, Americans seem to be making less fun of Bush's linguistic derelictions, whichever side they're on. Before the September 11th attacks and the Iraq War, the president's supporters could make light of his gaffes as harmless foibles. Now even that concession seems to undercut their efforts to drape a Churchillian mantle over the man and his language. An article in National Review goes so far as to describe him as speaking with Churchillian clarity. I doubt whether even the Daily Mail would have ventured that description for a British audience. Bush's language has become a less important issue for his American critics, too. Not that they don't still regard him as an ignorant pseudo-bumpkin who embarrasses the country, but now they're concerned that he's making America look bad in much more dangerous ways. Nowadays, their anger doesn't have to do with the fact that Bush doesn't talk like Tony Blair, or for that matter, that Tony Blair does.
Jeff Numberg is a linguist at Stanford University's Center for the Study of Language and Information and the author of The Way We Talk Now. Coming up, The Cat in the Hat Falls Flat. This is Fresh Air. Theodore Geisel, best known as Dr. Seuss, collaborated on the 1953 children's movie The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T, then largely ignored Hollywood. Since his death in 1991, however, two big-budget live-action adaptations of his most famous works have featured top comedians in heavy makeup, first Jim Carrey as the Grinch, now Mike Myers as the Cat in the Hat. Film critic David Edelstein is aghast that his five-year-old loved the new movie.
You see some scary stuff when you go to the movies, but for the kind of thing that Alex in A Clockwork Orange saw when they gave him a nausea drug and pried his eyes open with wires and screened atrocity footage, you have to get in line for the new Cat in the Hat picture with Mike Myers. I think it's one of the most repulsive children's movies ever made, a sloppy and vulgar burlesque of one of the great writers of the 20th century. Let me put this charge in context. When Theodore Geisel began writing his books for children more than half a century ago, they served as a wild corrective to the Dick and Jane school of moral hygiene. In a universe of parents always trying to rein in kids, often for the kids' own good, not to mention the good of furniture and upholstery, the Cat in the Hat gave permission for the most noisy and frenzied sort of destruction, destruction that even horrified the kids, who'd internalized some of their parents' edginess. But there's more than just liberating anarchism in the books of Dr. Seuss. There's also high elegance. The cat might be a force of disorder, but he's disorder in a top hat and bow tie and white gloves. He's the most radiantly serene of tricksters. The miracle of Dr. Seuss is in that balance between chaos and formality. It's that all that pandemonium arrives in meticulous stanzas of almost perfect anapestic tetrameter. What Mike Myers and director Bo Welch and a battery of screenwriters have done is turn the Cat in the Hat into Austin Powers with furballs. It's a low-camp universe in which a vaguely 1950s conformity is undermined by scatological humor, belch and fart gags, and sniggery allusions to castration and to four-letter words. The music is grating and the colors garishly ugly, pea soup green and egg yolk yellow mixed with pink and lilac. Director Welch is a production designer who did amazing work with Tim Burton on Beetlejuice and Edward Scissorhands, but he doesn't move the camera, and he keeps all the action in the center of the frame where it congeals. We spend the first 15 minutes praying for the arrival of Myers to bring this corpse to life, then the next hour praying for an anvil to fall on his head. Myers doesn't have the lean silhouette of Dr. Seuss's cat. Physically, he's closer to Bert Lahr's Cowardly Lion, and his voice is Lahr's with a dash of Coffee Talk Long Island. What he sounds like is Joanne Worley from Laugh-In'. In this scene, which, believe it or not, is one of the funniest in the movie, he's harangued by a computer-generated goldfish, while the two kids, Sally and Conrad, played by Dakota Fanning and Spencer Breslin, look on in understandable horror.
Stop this right now!
Who said that?
Me! Remember the fish? Came home in a baggie, loved me for 2 weeks, and then nothing!
The fish is talking.
Well, sure, he can talk, but is he saying anything?
No.
Hey, Sox, can it? This cat should not be here. He should not be about. He should not be here when your mother is out.
Come on, kids. You're going to listen to him? He drinks where he pees.
You can hear how Sean Hayes, as the voice of the goldfish, rushes through the verse as if he thinks it's beneath him, and how Myers has to build the scene to a joke about peeing. As a fan of South Park and, yes, Austin Powers, I love gross-out humor as much as the next 12-year-old boy at heart. But it's not only alien to Dr. Seuss. It's third-rate Myers. The star works like mad to bring the Cat in the Hat to life. He prances around these inert frames. He even throws in a Saturday Night Live-style mock commercial that ends with his tail being whacked off. But it's wrong, and Myers must have sensed on some level that it's wrong, because that extra measure of elation in his best work is missing. The movie comes with an icky life lesson. The cat is trying to loosen up Sally and harness the creative energy of Conrad, who has run afoul of his single mom's suitor, a conniving Sharpie played by Alec Baldwin. He's the bad, repressive surrogate dad, and the cat is the good, liberating one. But it's hard to concentrate on the struggle when both dads are so revolting. What were the heirs of Dr. Seuss thinking when they took the money for this desecration? And what comes next? Horton hears a poo?
David Edelstein reviews films for Fresh Air and the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our show was produced today by Roberta Shorrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Sundance Channel, Film Starts Here, commercial-free features, documentaries, world cinema, and shorts, listings at sundancechannel.com, and from Bantam Books, a division of Random House Incorporated, publisher of Sickened, the memoir of a Munchausen by proxy childhood by Julie Gregory. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet novelist Lee Maynard. His new book is called Screaming with the Cannibals. It's a sequel to his controversial debut novel, Crumb, set in his home state of West Virginia. Join us for the next Fresh Air.